Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. Welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the bioscience sector in Arizona and where its leaders would like to take it. And we visit the Jane Goodall Archive at ASU. But first, the U.S.-Mexico border has been closed for months for cattle coming into this country. That's because of a flesh-eating parasite called New World Screwworm. It's been found in some cows in Mexico, and officials do not want it getting into the U.S. The parasite lays hundreds of eggs in its host and can affect any warm-blooded animals, including humans. It was eradicated in the 1960s but has since come back. Officials hope releasing sterile male flies into affected areas can once again bring the screwworm under control. The border closure and concern about the screwworm is impacting ranchers in the Mexican state of Sonora. KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky visited one of them and joins me now to talk about what they had to say. Good morning, Nina.
Good morning.
So can you sort of paint a picture for us? Tell us about the ranch you went to and sort of in a normal world, like what their relationship with the U.S. Beef industry would look like.
Yeah, totally. So I went to this ranch north of Hermosillo and talked to a fourth generation cattle rancher named Jesus Fienbris. You know, this business has been in his family for many, many generations. And that's something that he's really proud of. He works with his kids and, you know, he hopes his grandkids are someday going to do this work, too. He runs one of the bigger cattle operations here in the state of Sonora. And so like most of the cattle raised in the state, he raises his cows to be exported across the border. That means he and many of the other ranchers in Sonora are specifically thinking about, you know, a U.S. market and U.S. consumer demand when they're making decisions about genetics and things like that in their business. So the fact that they now can't export their cattle is really costly. You know, ranchers, including in Fienbris, are selling their cows here in Sonora, but at a much lower price than they planned to get when they bred those animals. And that's really frustrating for ranchers here because, and this is really important to note, there haven't been any cases of the screwworm here in Sonora. You know, Fienbris told me that he really wishes that the U.S. would make some sort of exceptions for ranchers in Sonora like him, who he says are following all the rules and doing everything right and still can't export their cattle. And, you know, this is one of many factors that's making it honestly really hard for a lot of these ranches to keep operating. A lot of cow ranching businesses here like Fienbris are third, fourth, generation businesses, and they're facing a ton of pressure right now. The drought in Sonora has also been really hard on them. And a lot of this has some ranchers thinking about how much longer, you know, they're going to be able to stay in this business if there is going to be a fifth or sixth generation.
What kinds of things are Fienbris and other ranchers in Sonora doing to try to make sure that screwworm does not end up in their cattle?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's lots of checks about what cattle can even enter the state of Sonora in the first place. Government officials are upping those kinds of veterinary checks. You know, Fienbris has this kit that he got from the Mexican government. It's a baggie and a canister. And if he finds any suspicious sort of maggots on his animals, he's supposed to send it in to the Mexican government. But, you know, he would say that he raises really high quality beef cows, beef cattle, and most of these flies, most of these maggots have been found on animals that have maybe moved through Mexico illegally from Central America. And so he really puts his quality of cattle in a different category as you know, other cattle. And you know, Mexico is really upping sort of protocols like this in lots of different states, especially Sonora feels like it's been really proactive about, you know, making sure that all of the cattle in the state are healthy.
So how big of a deal is cattle ranching in Sonora? And you mentioned that some number of ranchers are saying maybe this isn't for us anymore. Like, how big of a deal is it right now? And what could it look like if this continues for much longer?
Yeah, I mean, you know, culturally, ranching is a really important part of the fabric of Sonora. You know, tacos de carne asada are everywhere for a reason, right, Mark? You know, like you go to taco places and it's red meat from cattle oftentimes raised here in Sonora. So, you know, it just feels like a really important part of the culture. You know, experts I talk to guess that most ranches in the state will be able to survive this, but it's really going to be the hardest on smaller ranches. And those are often the ranches, like in everything, that are the most likely to have to close. But it all really comes down to how much longer the border stays closed, and that's really the big unknown here.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about what kind of impact this is having on this side of the border as well. Beef prices are up. I mean, if there's a different supply or maybe less supply, that of course is going to generally raise prices. But what is it doing to beef prices here, and what is it doing to the supply chain of this product?
Yeah, so you know, beef prices in the US are really high right now. And that has a lot to do with the fact that cattle supplies in the US are really low right now. You know, demand for beef is high, and basic economics will tell us what to, you know, to expect what's happening right now. High beef prices, you know, according to federal data, uncooked beef in the US is more than 10% more expensive than it was this time last year. That far outpaces the rate of inflation. And supplies in the US are even lower because there aren't any Mexico. That's definitely not helping with those beef prices. But you know, that's a calculation that the US is willing to make because it could be really bad for US ranchers if the screwworm were to cross the border.
Yeah, what would that mean for U.S. ranchers if that were to happen?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should talk a little bit about what the screwworm is. It's, as you, like you said, a flesh-eating parasite, burrows into the flesh of warm-blooded animals, cattle most commonly, but they can affect any warm-blooded animal. So that includes wildlife and pets and humans. And once those larvae develop into flies, they're really hard to stop. You know, you can't stop a fly at a border checkpoint and make it get a vet check like you can with cattle. So, you know, the US really doesn't want the fly to come in because it would be really hard to stop once it's here. And that could be really devastating for you know, ranchers in the United States.
So what, in the last minute or so that we have, Nina, like what is likely to be next year? What is the U.S. doing to try to stop this? And maybe how optimistic are Sonoran ranchers that that will be successful?
Yeah, so you know, experts agree that the best way to eradicate the New World screwworm, and actually the way the US did eradicate it many decades ago, is by releasing, like you said, all of these millions of sterile flies into the environment. And when those flies mate, they don't produce any offspring, so that really dwindles the population to nothing. But because the New World screwworm hasn't been a problem in the US for many decades, those efforts really need to be ramped up. And that could take some time. You know, experts tell me it could potentially take years to really get this outbreak totally under control. Sonoran ranchers are really hopeful that the border shutdown won't last for years. But all of this process is going to require really close collaboration and cooperation with officials in Mexico.
All right. That is Nina Kravinsky from KJZZ's Hermosillo Bureau. Nina, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
The Flynn Foundation recently released the latest version of its bioscience roadmap for Arizona. It's basically a guide to the sector in the state and a list of goals for the next 5 years and ways to reach them. The first roadmap came out more than two decades ago. Among the goals outlined in this version, increasing collaboration between different entities, increasing the bioscience workforce, and improving the startup and entrepreneur environments. Mary O'Reilly is Vice President of Bioscience Research Programs at the Flynn Foundation. She joins me to talk more about this. And Mary, why is it so important to have a roadmap and specific goals in this particular sector?
Yeah, well, it's an important sector in general. So the biosciences, I think people might better understand it generally as the life sciences. Mm-hmm. So what are the areas that are important to us maintaining health and wellness in the longer term? So we're talking about cures for Alzheimer's. We're talking about like the spectacles we're wearing, like how do we develop those? How do we sort of help children with autism? You know, these are all of the challenges that the bio and life sciences are addressing, in addition to other areas like in agriculture. We need heat-resistant crops, et cetera. So these are the types of problems we're solving. And the reason why it's important to Arizona is we have a lot of assets here. We need to diversify and have a diversified population. So why would we not use the assets which we have, i.e. great universities, great institutions, a very strong agriculture section? Why would we not use that for the benefit of the population at large?
Are there particular areas of bioscience where Arizona has done well over the last decade or more?
Yeah. So at this point in time, we've about 140,000 people involved or engaged in the bioscience. 100,000 of those would actually be in the hospital system, and 40,000 are in the companies spread across the state. So you have W. L. Gore up in Flagstaff. You have the likes of Medtronic and Stryker and many others. Dexcom are all here in the valley. And then as you move south, you have organizations like Ventana. So it really is, it's the building up of companies like that. And we can do it either by bringing in new large companies or by growing some of our own.
Is one of those preferable to the other?
I would say at this point we're still in the growth phase. So I think time will tell which one might be the stronger. At this point in time, certainly medical devices is stronger than, let's say, our pharmaceutical sector. But you know, there's opportunities in other sectors, but perhaps they're still in their infancy at this point.
All right. So where are some of those opportunities? What are some areas maybe where Arizona hasn't been as robust or as successful as advocates would like?
Yeah. You know, the areas like gene and cell therapy is an area of increasing sort of interest broadly. And if you look at the U of A was and has talked about investing in that space, building the new CAMI building downtown Phoenix, you know, that's an area of growth and where we have an opportunity maybe to leapfrog other areas as a potential area of high strength. The areas of neurology and neuroscience, we have real strengths at Barrow Neurological Institute that we can capitalize on. I mean, when you think that the first Neuralink, the first device chip was placed into somebody's brain, and that was done here in Phoenix. So, you know, these are strengths.
Let me ask you about funding for some of these projects, because obviously NIH grants are in some ways in question. Other federal research dollars are very much in question. So let me ask first off, like, what does uncertainty do for both the institutions that are doing this research and for the research itself?
Uncertainty, I think, can have two. There are two aspects to uncertainty. One, it can actually breed innovation, but also a level of certainty. There has to be a level of certainty. So the hope is that after this period of disruption, that we can get back to having a long sight into what the future is going to hold. Whatever is happening here in Arizona, whatever happening in the state, I mean, I think everybody has to remember, we're competing on a global scale. So if we're not focused on that, if we don't put everything in place to be able to do that, then as a, you know, a state and a country, we're putting ourselves at a disadvantage.
Are there other pots of money available? Like, is this something that philanthropy would yeah. play a role in? Or are there, other than, for example, federal grants, are there other places to look for research dollars?
Yeah. Philanthropy will never be able to fill the gap. The NIH is the largest private funder of research in the world. Industry obviously spends an awful lot more money, actually, considerably more than the NIH or other federal organizations on research. But their research tends to be at a later stage. So they tend to be more on the development and translation, you know, the development of a product.
More actionable type stuff, right? As opposed to the initial research.
Yeah. So again, as these challenges arise, you know, a lot of dialogue is occurring to say who's going to be filling certain gaps.
So you have put forward a roadmap here. I'm curious, when you look 10, 15 years down the road at the bioscience sector in Arizona, what do you see?
Yeah, well, what I would see is hopefully we have, if today, and again, it's an estimate, but if we have 10 really strong companies, so it would absolutely, in a country or in a state where we have over 7 million people, we need two hands to count them on, not just one. Yeah. So we definitely need larger companies. We need to have a larger workforce. You know, these are high paying jobs. They pay over $25,000 over an average wage. with very good career pathways. So there's high value to having these in the economy. So that would be the goal, is can we create jobs? Can we give people an opportunity to build really strong careers for themselves? And we have a young population coming up that need to have access to good jobs, and this is one way.
Is it realistic, do you think, for Phoenix or for Arizona at some point to be sort of competitors with a place like Boston, which has been doing this kind of work for so long, or Austin, Texas, or San Diego, places that really have very well-established, long-standing bioscience sectors? Could the Valley or Arizona as a state be in that conversation?
I think we certainly have the opportunity to be in the conversation in specific areas. I mean, what we have to remember is we're talking about a roadmap that was first devised just over 20 years ago, and you're looking at areas that have been in this space for well over 100 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not going to catch up, basically. They have strengths, they're going to continue to have strengths, but we will catch up and we will leap forward in very specific areas. So we have opportunities like in the use of AI in the development of new therapies, gene and cell therapy, as I mentioned, medical devices, you know, smart devices. We're going to be using medical devices that are talking to us and telling us, you know, when we should go and see the dentist, you know, and things like that. So there's lots of opportunities to specialize, and we're going to do that. I don't think we have no capacity to be a Boston, and I don't think the public actually. You know, we don't want to be a Boston. We have different assets. And one of the real strengths, actually, and a really nice thing that's beginning to sort of come to the fore is the semiconductor industry. And this intersection of medical devices and semiconductors, we're very unique in that. I think Ireland does have some of those assets too, and maybe in Israel. But here we are sitting in Arizona with some of the biggest or strongest semiconductor assets. And at the same time, we have a medical device industry. And those two are absolutely the, you know, every pacemaker has chips, you know. So this is an area we can really be strong.
All right. That is Mary O'Reilly, Vice President of Bioscience Research Programs with the Flynn Foundation. Mary, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger.
Arizona is in the midst of the worst measles outbreak it has seen in decades. Cases are mounting. As of this week, they're up to 123 in the area around the northern Arizona town of Colorado City and its Utah sister city, which sits just on the other side of the state border, Hilldale. The area collectively is known as Short Creek. And when you hear Short Creek, it's pretty likely you'll think of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the polygamist offshoot of the LDS Church. Short Creek has been an FLDS enclave for decades, the site of federal raids, the arrest of polygamist leader Warren Jeffs, and countless news stories featuring footage of women in long prairie dresses with puff sleeves. Now, you might assume that this is a community where no one vaccinates their kids for religious reasons, and that's why it's the site of this historic measles outbreak. And you'd be right. Arizona Department of Health Services records show very low vaccination rates in Colorado City. One school there reported a kindergarten MMR vaccination rate of just 7%, the lowest in the state. In neighboring Hilldale, the Utah Health Department tells us 17% of kindergartners at the school in that town are fully vaccinated. But our next guest says the reason behind those low vaccination rates is not what you might think. Donia Jessup is the mayor of Hilldale. She grew up in the FLDS community there, but left the church in 2012. She and her family fled Short Creek at the time, but she came back and became the first woman to ever run the town and the first not endorsed by the FLDS church. On her first day in office, she was locked out of City Hall. Now she is the force behind a movement to bring Short Creek out of the shadow of Warren Jeffs. The area is trying to rebrand itself as a tourist mecca. It's just miles from Zion National Park and sits amid the red rocks of this high desert region. I spoke with Jessup more about the measles outbreak there and how it's hampering those efforts. And it's today's deep dive.
Hilldale, Colorado City communities have really had a complete change of the culture. It used to be like 95% FLDS.
Right.
Over the last 15 years, even 10 years, It has changed, and it looks like it's about maybe 5% of the population
Wow.
are still FLDS or look like they're FLDS. You know, that's so hard. Just because they're wearing that dress doesn't mean they're actually FLDS. But that we feel like might follow Warren Jeffs is about 5%.
So you grew up in the FLDS Church, I understand, but you left in 2012. You left Short Creek for a while, came back, and now you're mayor. You're in your second term, running for your third. I wonder, like, from your experience in that community, and even as it's changed a lot, are those two things linked, the lack of vaccine skepticism, and the FLDS Church?
Yes, it is absolutely linked. So there's a couple of things, though, that I really wish people would understand, and maybe we could add this to the story because it's my thinking. It's me trying to put the puzzle pieces together. Why are we where we're at right now? So, as a member of the FLDS Church, I chose to immunize my kids. I was immunized as a child. My family comes from a medical background. I read about immunizations. My sister is the Mojave County nurse there in the community. And so I have always trusted her. She's helped me get my children immunized, and many, many, many of the FLDS immunize their children. So my thinking in going through this is when Warren Jeffs started to tear families apart, everyone was living in trauma brain. And then children were taken and given to other families. I mean, everyone knows the story of that. They weren't thinking about, oh, it's immunization time, or it's been 3 months. We need to get. We were all living in such trauma that that was not one of the things we were thinking about. If you weren't sick right then, we weren't thinking about immunizations. And I think what we're seeing is the aftermath, some of the unintended consequences of the Warren regime.
That's fascinating. So you're saying there is a connection between not having your children vaccinated and being a member of the FLDS Church, but maybe not the one that we might assume. Like, this might just be a consequence of the kind of trauma that the community was put through.
Because I'm like, there's got to be more to this puzzle because Warren hasn't been teaching anything like this for over 20 years. And these are young kids right now, so their parents would be people that were the children when Warren was in full control. And so this is the next generation, but now they're having to decide what they're going to do. So we have seen a sharp uptake of immunizations during all of this.
So that's fascinating. So it sounds like this outbreak of measles in the community at this moment has sparked a conversation, and lots of families who maybe didn't have their children vaccinated for various reasons are thinking about doing it now or are doing it now. You're seeing rates go up.
For sure, the rates are going up. And, you know, the conversations are being talked about both ways. Reasons to immunize, reasons not to immunize. So it's the same conversations that other people have in their communities. But the health department, the schools, the city have pushed out a lot of information so people can make an educated decision. And what I've done as mayor is just say, I'm here to support you. This is your choice. I can't just get out and say, hey, go immunize your children. Everyone has their belief systems. There are some that have a religious belief to not have your children immunized. I would never infringe on that. And so I have just been very careful to not tell anybody what to do. I mean, gosh, we had that with Warren Jeffs. That's not who I am. That's not my job.
So what is being done from your point of view in the county to try to stem the tide of these measles cases, which can be deadly?
Oh, they're doing everything in their power to stem the tide. They're educating, they're making themselves available to make sure that they are there to immunize pretty much on their time frame, whatever they can do to help. They have gone above and beyond.
I also want to talk about the moment that this is happening in Short Creek, because this is a time when the community, you are trying to really rehab the public image of this place, make it welcoming, tourist friendly. You're right by Zion. Phoenix Magazine just did a big feature on you and efforts there in Short Creek to become sort of a tourist destination in that region. Does this measles outbreak put a damper on that conversation?
I don't know. It feels like we worked so hard And it's just one thing after the other. And I have a hard time sometimes just feeling like, when is Warren Jeffs going to stop having a sway in what happens? You know, because some of the choices that were made 20 years ago are cropping up now. And it's like we have to continue going forward, pushing the wall back, just keep going, just keep going. And it can sometimes become very discouraging. And it's not, I'm not discouraged with the choices people are making or anything like that. It's the perception. It's that we're in the news one more time. You know, we're in the news in a negative way. And I don't want people to feel like they're pressured or being bullied by the media or anyone else because of this. Does that make sense? Because all these years, it just feels like just negative, 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 and we've worked so hard, but we're still going to have things. And some of the things that Warren did are going to crop up for generations. So we just have to keep standing for the right, speaking up for the good. I don't know. It gets rough sometimes.
We asked the Utah Health Department about the most recent vaccination rates in Hilldale and if they've documented that uptick Mayor Jessup mentioned there. They told us that their data shows about 14% more MMR vaccines given out in that region in the last several months than the same time the year before. We'll hear more of this deep dive conversation, including why the mayor came back to this embattled town, after the break.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Lauren Gilger.
Let's return now to my deep dive conversation with Hilldale, Utah Mayor Donia Jessup. Her town, as well as neighboring Colorado City, Arizona, are dealing with a growing measles outbreak, just as she and others there have tried to open up the former FLDS enclave and get out from under the shadow of convicted polygamous leader Warren Jeffs. You've made a lot of progress there, right? Like, you're the first woman to become mayor of this town. That was very controversial, I know. You zoned the town.
Right.
You've brought in businesses. You're kind of opening it up to the outside world in this new way at this moment.
Right.
Do you think the world is ready for it? Like being in the news right now for a measles outbreak is not helping, obviously, but will this kind of legacy of child abuse and Warren Jeffs and federal raids always haunt this area?
I think that when you look in the history books, that's always going to be what leads out. You know, we see that in Germany still with the history that's there. And then when the history is tried to be erased, then it's no, it happened.
Yeah.
And so it will always be in the history book. That's what the community was based on, what it was founded on. I want my legacy to be the good changes that happened there and that I let out in that. I know that will be in the history books too. I think it will take several generations before people stop talking about it first thing. It's going to take a few generations for some of the, how do I say, some of the hurt to not be transferred onto the next generation.
Yeah.
So that generation can live above it all, not in it. And so it's going to take some time, but it starts with us. It starts with this generation.
Let me ask you about that, because one of the things I've read also about Short Creek right now is that lots of former FLDS folks like yourself are coming back. Like, that's a big chunk of the population right now. And part of the reason it's growing there and changing. Why did you come back? Why do you want to take up that mantle? Why not go start a new life somewhere else?
Right. So I had moved away. I had moved away for 3 years. And my husband at that time came to me and said, "Hey, the mountains are calling me home." And I said, "Well, isn't that nice for you? I guess we're getting a divorce." And he said, "Make me a list of reasons why you would go back and why you wouldn't go back."
Yeah.
And I said, on the top of that list of wouldn't go back was because I said it, I never would. That's why. But there was a very long list of reasons to go back. And that all had to do with my love for the community and for the people and where I was raised. That red dirt flows through my veins. And the injustices that were committed upon the people just angered me. And it didn't anger me in a way to just sit back and, "Can you swear on your radio show?"
Yes.
Oh, okay.
We can bleep it.
You know, Right? If you just want to sit back and bitch about what happened to you can do that, or you can step up and make the changes. And there are so few people that are willing to step up and do what's right because it's the right thing to do. Step up and be a voice for people who might not know how to use their voice or not be able to use their voice. So I had become a crime victim advocate over the time that I was away. And so when I moved back, I came back with a crime victim advocate heart and an advocate's voice and an advocate's mind. And so when I went home, I didn't go home to be mayor. I went home to just be a part of the solution. Within the year, that next year, I was mayor. And so it felt like almost a calling. It was just a very interesting thing. I had no idea what that was, where we were headed with that, or what would happen. I went into this role not knowing how to be a mayor, not knowing about politics or government. People now they're like, "You make a good politician." And I'm like, "I'm not a politician. I'm a leader." And there's a big difference. And so I went back simply because I wanted to be a part of the solution. I wasn't
Gotcha.
willing to sit back and let Warren Jeff's abuse of people just continue and destroy our community any further.
Do you feel like you've been successful in that?
100%. Yes. The place has turned around so much. It is so beautiful. The town is open, fences are down. But and I'll tell you this. People say, "How do we know that it'll never go back to another Warren Jeffs walking in and taking over the town?" And the simple answer is private land ownership. The communities were owned by the church, and that is being dismantled. So it is not owned where one man can control everything. I moved four times by a knock on the door, and we're supposed to move you. Go over to your sister's house or go over to your mother's house. We'll let you know where you live in the morning.
Wow.
So nobody can ever do that to me again. Nobody can come in and just control and say, "If you don't be obedient, you're going to lose your family."
Yeah.
So honestly, the short answer of how does this never happen again here? Private land ownership.
That's really interesting. I mean, let me ask you lastly just what you want folks to know. I mean, like, this is an important, it sounds like, transition that you're trying to make for this town, but it keeps being set back as we're seeing right now with measles. I
Yeah,
mean,
one step forward, three steps back.
yeah, what do you want folks to know?
We're not scary. We're open. I rebranded Hilldale City to Welcome Home, and there was a reason for that. For all of those who stayed but live in a completely different community than it used to be, welcome home. For those who fled or were sent away and found their way back, welcome home. And for those who didn't even know what Hilldale was and never lived there before, but have since visited and fell in love with the beauty and ended up moving home, welcome home.
All right. We'll leave it there for now. That is Dania Jessup, the mayor of Hilldale, Utah, joining us. Thank you so much, Mayor, for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Back in the early 2000s, an Arizona artist took a day job to pay the bills. It was a choice that would eventually transform his entire perspective. My co-host Sam Dingman spoke with him last year.
It's a Tuesday morning in Ajo, Arizona, about 40 miles from Mexico. I'm touring the studio of photographer Tom Kiefer.
These are all hand-embroidered mantas. These are meant as like little food, the whole food. So
they're beautiful.
They're incredible. And they're generally made by the woman for their beloved who is about to embark on a long journey. So this is a symbol of devotion.
Kiefer points to the border of the montas, which is made of intricately braided purple fabric.
I mean, I don't know how many dozens and dozens of hours was spent on this. It's shape of a flower, the border. And then in the middle, it has these two birds, and it says, "You are my love." I mean, these are precious.
Behind the drawer full of montas, there's a table where Kiefer has a box of spoons, another one full of deodorant, and a collection of children's toys, including an orange puppet.
Oh, you mean the dinosaur?
T-Rex,
I think. It's something that meant so much to the person that was carrying it. Perhaps it was brought along because it was going to be a gift.
Tom Kiefer's studio is packed with stuff like this, literally floor to ceiling. Jackets, Bibles, blankets, a compass, decks of cards, and thousands, he's counted, of toothbrushes.
Imagine that you had to leave your house and that you only had a backpack. And so you take everything that's important and precious to you with you. I mean, when I found my first Bible and rosary, I was shocked that an item like that would be taken away.
Kiefer started collecting this stuff back in 2007 when he took a job as a janitor at a border patrol station just outside of town.
It was $10.42 an hour, which was absolutely executive pay, at least here in Ajo. I moved to Ajo so I could do my photography, which was photographing our country, the things that make America, America.
The job was pretty simple. Basically, lifting giant garbage bags onto a wheelbarrow and taking them to the dumpster. But one day, Kiefer got curious about why the bags were so heavy. So he looked inside and discovered that the food that migrants and asylum seekers had been carrying when they arrived at the border was being confiscated and thrown away.
Any of the food that they were carried was considered contraband because you don't know. There could be drugs in there.
Kiefer went to his boss and asked permission to take the food from the garbage bags and donate it to a local food bank. His boss said, sure. So Kiefer started digging through all the trash bags before he put them on the wheelbarrow.
So I'd go in and dig out the cans of food, and then I would see a Bible, a rosary, a wallet with identification in it. And it's just like, holy, I mean, what is going on here?
Kiefer was appalled at the scope of what was being seized. What, he wondered, was the point of separating people from their underwear and toiletries and food? Or worse, from their hand-sewn montas, their personal diaries and photographs?
You know, these items were the things that sustained them in their journey here. The policy was any item that's considered non-essential or potentially lethal would be subject to confiscation. I mean, really what it was just punishment. You know, let's take away, you know, these items that mean so much. It was punitive.
So Kiefer decided to do something his boss hadn't given him permission to do. Whenever he opened up a garbage bag to take out unused food, he would also take the personal items. At first, he stored them in his house, and eventually here at the studio. In 2013, he began to photograph them.
I had to show how extensive this was. I needed a record to show what was happening.
Eventually, Kiefer began to exhibit these photographs. It's a project he calls El Sueño Americano, the American Dream. Many of the images focus on a single item, a canteen or a piece of jewelry.
These items should not have been taken in the first place. And the way that I photograph it, it's simple. I don't want to get too artistic and carried away. I mean, just these are the items. And so let's give them their moment to shine. Who carried this? What was their story?
There also is this way, is just as we're looking at all this stuff that I can't stop thinking about, there would be no way for you to photograph the person
who brought
these things. And so in a way, these objects have to stand for the people.
Right. And, you know, that's why I want to show them in a way that is just reverence and respect.
One of the photographs shows an empty bottle of cologne.
You know, they even drank the cologne to survive. But the other thing is the high alcohol content acted as a salve. You know, so get your arms, legs, get all scraped up. So it was like an antiseptic.
Another image shows a deck of cards.
It's the Ace of Spades. And there's this graphic that's superimposed on top of the ace. And it says, all in. I mean, anyone deciding to make that journey, you better believe that they're all in. I mean, this is America.
That was my co-host Sam Dingman speaking last year with photographer Tom Kiefer. And you are listening to the show. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Jane Goodall, the famed primatologist and conservationist, among other roles, died earlier this month at the age of 91. She's perhaps most famous for her work studying chimpanzees in Gombe National Park in Tanzania. But now that work is housed at ASU. The Jane Goodall Archive sits in a room filled with filing cabinets at the Institute of Human Origins in the Walton Center for Planetary Health building on the Tempe campus. The archive is owned by the Jane Goodall Institute, which continues to fund data collection in Gombe with some help from ASU. Ian Gilby is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change and a research scientist in the Institute of Human Origins at ASU. He oversees the archive. When I visited recently, we sat at a table surrounded by, as Gilby put it, literally every piece of paper that's ever come out of Gombe National Park in Tanzania, where Jane Goodall did her pioneering chimpanzee work. He also explained how the archive ended up at ASU.
Long story. It's a typical academic story, but in short, my PhD advisor, Ann Pusey, was a student of Jane's in the 70s at Gombe, and she essentially, when Jane famously switched from doing research to focusing on conservation in the 80s, the data were continuing to be collected by Tanzanian field assistants in the at Gombe. So literally every day we've got field assistants out following chimpanzees, systematically collecting data. And these data were piling up in Jane's house in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, because Jane was off saving the world, essentially. And so Anne asked Jane if she could curate and work with the data. So it moved first to the University of Minnesota. I came on as a graduate student in 1997 with Anne, and did my dissertation using the long-term data as well as my own observations at Gombe. And then I went off for various postdocs, and Anne moved to Duke along with the archive, and then she retired in 2019. And we decided that the archive should come to where I am, and which is ASU.
And how is it being used here? Like, how do you use it? How do students who come here use it?
I mean, we use it for many different things, but the main goal is to conduct research on chimpanzee behavioral ecology. These animals live for 50, 60 years. They reproduce really slowly, and you really need decades worth of data in order to answer some of the questions that we have.
And are you still getting updates? Like, do you still get new data from the field?
Every day, they are collecting the data as we speak. And at the moment, what happens is essentially the data are still collected on paper, and it builds up. And then when one of us goes to the field, we carry it back with us. But we scan it before we travel with it. And one of the things that I'm working on, and I have for a long time, is to streamline this process. So right now we're having some of the data being entered in the field and uploaded to the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, I should note that we are surrounded by a pretty good number of pretty deep filing cabinets. And as you mentioned before we started recording, they are full of paper, all of them. That's a lot to go through, and I would imagine if you're continuing to add on to that, digital might be the easier way to do it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in a perfect world, we'd have our field assistants collect data on tablets in the forest as, you know, the behavior is happening. But for various reasons, mainly practical reasons, it's a tough ask. So what we decided to do was, rather than put our time into that, was to work with AI to extract data from the data sheets themselves.
What appeals to you so much about studying chimpanzees? Like, why are they so interesting to you?
I'm just fundamentally interested in animal behavior. I mean, I didn't end up here because I, you know, have this incredible love for chimps or anything like that. I mean, I do now, but that's not how it started. It started with just a general interest in animal behavior, and in particular, the sort of complicated social relationships that you find in some of these social creatures.
So how did your admiration maybe or appreciation for them evolve? Was it just a matter of doing this kind of work over a certain amount of time?
Pretty much, yeah. I had never been to Africa. I don't think I'd ever even seen a chimp in a zoo. As I said, I was just fascinated with animal behavior, social behavior in general. And so I had the opportunity to do this as a graduate student. And I went to Gombe first in 1999, and it changed my life. And I've gone back basically every year since.
What did you know of Jane Goodall's work before that first trip to Tanzania?
Only as much as the sort of scientifically literate public knew. You know, I'd seen all the documentaries, and I knew the general story. And in particular, you know, her pioneering ideas that animals aren't sort of robots, that they're individuals with personalities and variation in their personalities, and which is obviously, you know, something now it seems very obvious to us all, but, you know, back then, you know, animals were thought to be just sort of reactionary beings that didn't really have any personality.
Do you see what you're doing in some ways of continuing her work?
As much as anybody can continue. I mean, I've been asked that before. You know, she can't be replaced. There's no way. I mean, just but her, you know, her work recently, since the mid 80s, had been more conservation based, and, you know, essentially saving the planet. And so, in that sense, there's no way we could even begin to continue. So we do our best. We try to build on what she started, essentially.
So why do you think it's important? Like, what do we learn about maybe ourselves? What do we learn about the planet by studying chimpanzees and their behavior and how they interact with each other and themselves?
There are so many reasons why we study chimpanzees. I mean, for me, honestly, it's because I just find them fascinating. But they are a keystone species. So, you know, studying them, saving them saves critical habitat, right? It's been shown that sites with research stations are much more likely to persist than sites that aren't protected in any way. From a planetary perspective, again, understanding how animals interact with their environment and their ecosystem and what's important to them is, you know, regardless of what species it is, it's really important to know. From an anthropological perspective, chimpanzees are one of our two closest living relatives, and so we use them to sort of provide clues to what the behavior of the last common ancestor of humans and apes was like.
What have we learned recently? Like, what kind of research are you and others doing using this data now? And maybe what are some of the things that we're finding out recently?
So some of our recent work, we've looked at the form and function and development of male social bonds. So let's call them friendships. Basically, you have pairs of males who spend a lot of time together, grooming one another all the time, and supporting each other in conflicts with others. And it's, you know, one of the things that Jane witnessed early on and suspected that there was some sort of value to these relationships. And now, 65 years later, we're able to test that hypothesis. And sure enough, we found that pairs of males who have strong social bonds are more likely to rise higher in the dominance hierarchy. They're more likely to sire offspring for males of that rank. And these bonds do essentially last for, you know, they can last for decades.
So when you think about what's in all of these filing cabinets and what's in the scan documents that you have, what do you think about sort of the body of work overall? Like, what comes to mind for you about its significance, its importance, its maybe interest to you and other folks who do what you do?
I mean, this is literally, you know, a unique resource that's unmatched. There are many other very, very strong, very good long-term chimpanzee projects, which I've actually also worked on as well. But this is sort of the iconic original one, the longest running one. So it's symbolic in a way, as well as being incredibly valuable.
Ian Gilby is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change and a research scientist in the Institute of Human Origins at ASU. And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thanks, as always, for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.